This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
It's a wonderful morning of August, I mean of autumn. And I'm always amused before the Dharma talk. And last time I gave a talk, and I was almost complaining about the last line, "I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words," because it sounds very grandiose. It seems to assume that whoever is speaking is the Tathagata, or he's a channel or something. And anyway, it struck me as just unnecessarily sort of overdone. And so the word Tathagata is an interesting word. The Tata part means something like as it is, or thusness. And the gata part means gone. So the sort of literal translation is thus gone, the thus gone person. And there's another understanding of it, that it's really, because the second A is a long A, it could also mean tata agata. So connecting tata and agata becomes tathagata, just like this. But the agata means come or arrived or something, thus arrived. So if you look at the great sage of our time, Wikipedia, it has quite a discussion about Tathagata, so you can sort of investigate it as well. But this whole term can sort of imply, or we can understand it to mean that which is now, that which is this. And the words can be understood as the communication or what we receive from this, which in which we are completely engaged. So it's nice to sort of look at that in a larger context, and look at it also historically. There's been a lot of discussion about this term. So it's, at the least, it's a call for us to wake up, to be here in this which is happening now. I mentioned at the session that we had just recently that I was I have not forgotten the words I heard from Jhana, who was a monk who lived here for a while during a rather tumultuous time at Jikoji. She was part of the tumult, of course. And her insight or her radiance was more of a strobe light radiance, just brilliant and dark, and brilliant and dark. And from my Taoist perspective, that's absolutely on point, because all of this talk about enlightenment often just seems to, we seem to think that the more enlightenment, the better, more light, and so on and so on and so on. But we forget about endarkenment. We don't realize, or we don't accept the fact that within enlightenment is endarkenment. If you remember the yin and yang symbol in the Taoism, the yang form has yin in it, and the yin form has yang in it. So I think it's helpful for us to realize that endarkenment is an essential part of enlightenment, whatever that may mean. I mean, you can go on and on about about that. But that's an important understanding. It's something that I wish I had had when I went to Japan in the 60s. I was looking for the ideal teacher. And you know, if you're in Kyoto, Japan, that's the center of Zen or of history or of everything, Japanese culture. And I couldn't find any teacher there. Not that I was looking terribly hard, because there's also the sense that the teacher and you will come together. It's not only your thing, it's also everything. So I didn't find the ideal teacher there. There wasn't any ideal person. So I was looking for this complete enlightenment sense, and I didn't realize there needs to be some endarkenment. Doesn't have to be, it can't be a perfect person. So that's what we need to keep that in mind, I think. And what the thing that Jhana said when she was here, when she was, after she left here, she was very ill, and I visited her when she was basically on her deathbed. And her comment to me was, every breath is a gift. And I very much appreciate not only that message or that understanding, but the way that it was conveyed to me. She didn't say, you should believe that every breath is a gift or something like that. She just said, out of her experience, every breath is a gift. So that was a teaching that could be well received. I didn't have to resist it by something I had to do or not do. And long before that, when I had visited in Japan again, maybe in the 80s, I visited Kobori Nanre, who was the abbot of one of the sub-temples at Daitokuji. And I had worked with him in the 60s, because he wrote articles in English, and he asked me to check them over, edit them, and so on. So I knew him pretty well. And when I visited him in the 80s, he himself was quite old and ill with arthritis and so on. It was very painful for him even just to come into the room to converse. And he said, nowadays I don't even say anything about Zen. The only thing that matters is to sit together in the same room and breathe. So there are two things in Buddhist understanding that I would like to affirm or go over, and one is pratityasamutpada, or the profound interdependence of all things. because all things are interdependent, none of them have any sort of lasting essence. So they are understood to be empty in a fundamental way, that they don't have any lasting essential reality. So in the Heart Sutra, you could look at page 5. if you go about 10 lines down, the second time you see Shariputra saying, "Shariputra, all dharmas are marked with emptiness." And then another understanding of that, or another translation of that, is that all phenomena are empty, without characteristics. And then the next line, "They do not appear nor disappear." And this translation is "unproduced and unceased, are not tainted nor pure." This is translated as "stainless, not and not stainless." So not tainted nor pure. Then "do not increase nor decrease, undiminished, unfilled." So I like to hear other views or translations of very familiar terms, because we hear them so much, they get a little dull in our experience. So this sense of the profound interdependence of things has all of these ramifications, including the fact that everything can be understood as empty or without self or impermanent. But it's also that they are profoundly interrelated. So in a more positive sense, everything is connected to everything else. And of course, the great metaphor is Indra's net, where place, each knot of the net is a jewel, and that jewel reflects every other jewel. So it's just an incredible sense of reality. And the net is not only like this, but it's also like this. It's just an incredible reality that we cannot comprehend. It's one reason in Christianity we have angels, because they sort of mediate between the profundity and the great reality, and they sort of cushion the reality. They go between the reality and us, our understanding of it. And I think perhaps Buddhism also functions as a kind of cushion, because the true reality in which we are embedded is so incomprehensible. If we could comprehend it, we would probably, we would no longer be somehow. There is a criticism of this kind of very broad understanding of the profound interdependence of all things. Do all phenomena causally influence each other? If that's the case, if we were the heirs of other people's deeds, the whole moral edifice would collapse. So you don't want to just hang on to this profound interdependence of all things as a great idea. You need to investigate it and see how does it actually work out in our ways of relating to our immediate reality and the larger reality of the world around us. Is everything completely causing or influencing everything, and therefore there's no way for accountability? How could it ever be worked out? So it's just a big question. So is there a kind of ruthless connectedness? That's something that we can just, we have to sit with. So this understanding of reality as Indra's net, or as a profound interrelatedness of all things, this is a kind of view. So it's an understanding which has been enunciated and which people have celebrated and been in awe of and have criticized as well. And in the Metta Sutta on page 9, which we read this morning, at the very bottom, he is not holding to fixed views, endowed with insight, freed from sense appetites. One who achieves the way will be freed from the duality of birth and death. So this not holding to fixed views is expressed as fundamental to our freedom from birth and death, from plus and minus, from this and that. Another translation of that basic phrase is, by not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desire, is not born again into this world. So the idea of having a fixed view is a kind of extension and understanding of this profound interdependence of all things. Any view that we might have itself is impermanent and not lasting, and so on and so forth. But it makes the it makes our life a bit tricky when we if we try hard not to hold on to fixed views. if we try to do that just because it's wrong, and so we have to keep changing our views, that's not a very good solution. But it's just this is just an expression of a person who is well along the way. These people have found that holding to a fixed view is not helpful. It doesn't mean that you don't operate with a lot of assumptions. We all have to operate with various assumptions, but our assumptions don't have to be, we don't have to be stuck in our assumptions. So not holding to fixed views is one of the modes of clinging that the Buddha was criticizing, or was felt was not to be practiced. So the Buddha expressed that we should not be clinging to sense desires. We should not cling to practices, rules, and conventions, even such things as the value of money or dogmas. And we should not cling to a sense of self. And we should not cling to views and opinions. So this, in these particular days, in this last few years, this clinging to views and opinions has become very tight. Many of us in this country and elsewhere are now very convinced that whatever our view is that it's the right one, and you are wrong if you don't hold it. So we are not only clinging, we're clutching our fixed views. There was an interesting discussion of this, an interesting example of this sort of thing that's recorded from Thailand. The famous teacher Ajahn Chah. Chah was his first American student, Ajahn Sumedho, was living at the monastery. And over the years, Ajahn Sumedho, this American, was adjusting to life there as a monk and so on. But there was one Thai monk there, very different from all the other Thai monks, who was rather opinionated and would express himself very strongly and would just make people uncomfortable. And so Ajahn Sumedho was quite disturbed by this person because he wasn't really following the Buddhist path properly. And so it so happened that Ajahn Chah went away for a few days. And then when there was and then there happened to be the meeting of the Sangha at the temple. And so during that meeting, Ajahn Sumedho brought up his criticism of this monk. And he just spoke in the meeting how this monk was not doing well, and it was very disturbing to him. And the monk whom he was criticizing was attending the meeting, and his face was down. And then after the meeting, that monk who had been criticized left the monastery. And then Ajahn Chah came back, the teacher came back. And then when he discussed the matter with Ajahn Sumedho, the teacher agreed that this monk had been very troublesome and was certainly problematic. But he had been at other monasteries and they had all thrown him out. So he was being allowed to stay in this monastery, and maybe he would be working things out. But since you have criticized him, and now he has left the monastery, and you have caused a deeper disruption in his life, and we don't know what can transpire now. Even though you were right, I mean, he wasn't being the ideal monk, and your points were all correct. To bring them out as you did in this environment, and given the history, it's not. The really proper way to handle this your strong view. So apparently this was a very, of course, a great teaching for Ajahn Sumedho. Sumedho. And I guess he discussed that many times later on, because it was so important for him. So we can have our opinions and so on, but we have to have this lack of clinging in order to really exist in the reality of our lives. So if you have the opinion that like I have a Toyota pickup, it's the best truck, the best car in the world, and I'll continue to have that view until something happens, you know. But I have to be open to that. It may not. That opinion of mine may not be something I can cling to forever. So we can certainly operate with many views. I mean, we have to have our views and our opinions, but we just don't need to latch onto them as if they are our salvation. And I think one reason that we are having this problem in our whole society is because people somehow feel that there isn't anything else that they can trust or hang on to. So whatever it is that we are hanging on to, we are hanging on because we feel that there isn't anything else which is going to support us. So I think when we come across people who are desperately clinging to a terrible idea, even to a good idea, but a terrible idea that we don't like, we have to understand where they are coming from. Our whole culture is, we have reached the end of the sort of Christian era. When I was little, everything was basically understood to be Christian. Everybody was some form of a Christian. And the holidays and everything were all thus. But now that whole underpinning has collapsed. Some people are desperately holding on to that, but not so many. And then, so if that's not holding us up, then we have to have something else. So some political truth or some economic truth or something we have to grasp desperately. So I think we have to more and more develop an understanding of the extremism that's going on and why it's going on, and to be prepared for interaction with people with those views, so that we don't, of course, get up in it ourselves. I mean, it's so easy for us to latch on to the opposite view to sort of confront. But there is something much deeper, which is evoking all of this kind of clinging and hope that some idea will be the perfect one. So we have the paticca samuppada, the profound interdependence of all things, and then we have the not holding to fixed views. Now, if we are able to understand and live these understandings to some extent without clutching them, also, we don't want to be clutching Buddhists. That would be a marvelous contradiction, which I'm sure is existing already. So with our hopefully we have a deeper insight and follow the path of the Bodhisattva. And the term Bodhisattva, sattva means seems to mean person in some sort, and Bodhi implies, Bodhi has quite a few interesting meanings. Can mean illuminated or enlightened intellect, perfect knowledge or wisdom. Can also mean awakener. And from that, it can also mean rooster. So I think we should call our teachers roosters. Not get them too elevated. And then we, it can be, of course, we know the Bodhi tree is the sacred tree. And as an adjective, Bodhi, of course, means wise or learned. So it has all of these elevated meanings. So here you see Bodhi. in our, we just had a calligraphy weekend with writing. Basically, we were learning to write these two characters. And over there, you can see one little example of the introduction work we did. We did number one and the word for person. The word for person is this lower part, these two lines means person. And the upper part of this of that character means fire. Oh, thank you.
That's okay.
So the upper part of the character means fire. And so this is a person carrying fire. So that means light. So this is the basic character meaning light. So what kind of light? Well, the upper character is a very interesting character. And I just realized in thinking about this talk that this character expresses the sense of endarkenment in enlightenment. Because this character is basically mountain. That's the vertical stroke and then the side strokes and the bottom stroke. So you have this mountain, vertical and two sides. And then in the mountain are these two angular characters. And though that is simply, it means a thread. It's basically two cocoons, which are making the thread. And so from that, it means something which is barely visible or something which is very small and can also mean hard to see or even dark. So in the valleys of the mountain, you have this vague or unclear or dark element. So this upper character can mean mystery or profundity. And it's used in Japan, it's used as one of the descriptions for the no drama, which is a very, it's an expression of the whole human, the profundity that's possible in human life in dance. And they use this term yu with the term gen, which means source. Yugen means the sort of most profound expression of profound expression in dance or in drama. So it's very interesting because this the term Bodhi, if you read the term Bodhisattva, for instance, or Bodhi in Chinese or Japanese, there are two characters for Bodhi. There's Bo and Dai, or Bodhi. And those characters don't have any real meaning as characters. The first character means grass, and the second character means carry. But so those two characters were adopted in Chinese because they have this pronunciation of Bo and Dai, or Bo Di. So those characters were adopted for their pronunciation. So they never have had meaning from the character directly. They are always understood to be a Sanskrit word. But so then Koban came up with these two characters with the meaning of Bodhi. So we have this profundity and we have light. So with this Pratityasamutpada, and then with not clinging to our views, perhaps we will have a sense of this kind of light in our awareness or in our consciousness. Thank you. If you have any comments, please make a comment.
So earlier when we were on the clear pass, I was relating more to this one other aspects of the figure on top. I think we talked about was some idea of mystery. Mm-hmm. But now I was just thinking much more clearly about this idea about this thread, the cocoon thread. It's a very, very fine thread. And the mountain is very large. So maybe that really it's about something very small. So which then I jump to what we would call needle in a haystack. But of course, the mountain is thousands of times bigger than the haystack. And the thread is many times thinner than a needle.
Yeah, that's fun. Thank you.
Do you put your hand up for him?
Just like this, yeah. Okay.
From my understanding, we cling to views as scaffolding.
At scaffolding?
Scaffolding. Hmm. Because without living inside and with love, we feel insecure. Mm-hmm. So like a building needs a scaffolding because it's not solid yet. Mm. And in the same way, from what I see, all this clinging and arguments are a function of lack or non-presence of love in the middle of existence for people. And for a long time, you mentioned, and indeed, I see the same thing, religion was a scaffolding for people. The sense of security that comes from belief. Mm-hmm. And that is that eroded. The outcome to me appears intensity of thinking, which looks at opinions.
Oh, thank you. Mm-hmm. I was interested to realize that Carl Jung, for instance, he was the son of a minister, and he his and his patients were often suffering from loss of the meaning of Christianity for them. And so he was looking, I guess, or he was understanding the need for something to help people. And one of the things that he began to use was dreams, because people cannot deny their dreams. Like, my dreams came out of me. They're not somebody else's imagination. So I can't deny them. And if I investigate them, I may find something of value. But he's not so popular nowadays, so I don't know. There are various understandings about dreams. And some people have found them extremely valuable in their lives, and other people just don't see them as relevant. Many scaffolds.
Thank you for your talk. I was starting to dream a little bit when you were talking, but I enjoy this metaphor, I guess, of scaffolding. And as you're talking with dreams, it sounds like the scaffolding isn't quite so rigid in dreaming. But it's come to my mind that what seems like in the sitting, that the possibility is that there is no, for a little while maybe, there's no scaffolding. There is no, it's like most of my life, all the time, I'm sort of tethered to conventions, or very secure to have these conventions. But sitting, sometimes, it seems like some of this falls away. And there's not a word for it, which is probably the good thing, because I believe words and language are a part of this tethering. It's very secure. I can say, oh, okay, that explains it. But that's not what I experience at times in sitting. It's inexplicable. It's, as we talked about a few weeks ago, about ritual. And I said, it's inexplicable. And the speaker wanted me to say more.
Explain yourself.
But she did say, which I really admire her quite a lot, Karen Tillis, she said, well, sitting is like a ritual. So I don't know if there's anything more to say.
Good. Any comment from the larger Zoom world? Yes, Randy?
Yeah.
Randy?
Yeah. Hi, Jerome.
Hi.
When you brought up it kind of gripped me, the idea of you're talking about the beginning enlightenment and endarkenment. And the only thing I could think of was it. And maybe it's way off, but you I like your feedback, is that when people become more, let's say, aware or enlightened or whatever, do they see the pain or the darkness of the world clearer or deeper or feel it more? I don't know. Is that connected at all? of awareness cuts both ways. That's the only I could think of, is endarkenment, enlightenment, but maybe there's something else to it.
Good, thank you. Certainly when you think of a person like Thich Nhat Hanh, his presence was not somebody who was just joyously happy. He conveyed a very different sense of awareness and presence, and he certainly was acquainted with grief and loss of every kind. Sarah?
Hello. I was curious. I sort of missed out on the first part of this, but the calligraphy of Koban's that is above you there, what is the Japanese word for that?
Or what Yuko. Huh? Yuko.
Yuko.
Yeah.
Oh, uh-huh. Why, is it like Y-U-K-O in English letters? Yuko. Oh.
And both U and the U and the O are long. Yuko.
Okay, yes. Thank you very much. I was glad to hear some of the calligraphy part of it and enjoyed your talking about the Heart Sutra. So thank you.
Certainly. Yeah, the ko is, the light is the same as the ko of Jikoji.
And the same as my Buddhist name is Myoko.
So uh-huh.
It's my ko also. Thank you.
Good. Anyone else have a comment?
I have one.
Yes.
So I like that you use the word investigate. It's something very important to do, especially when we hear others' opinions or even have our own opinions, to really investigate what's behind it. Is it true or not? I think we must investigate everything, even our Buddhist practice. That's something I think that the Buddha asked us to do, not to believe, but to investigate.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you for bringing in that word. It's very important. Thank you.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I hate to double dip, but I had thought about the, I did have some particular thoughts about, you know, the attachment to views and the recognition of mutual arising and these ideas about, you know, the meaningless, you know, the formlessness is not a thing. And so one of the things I think about when I'm most strongly trying to visualize what this means about is I feel, my feeling is I'm very attached to my identity as a separate human, and there's always other humans, but clearly we see, but the truth of the matter is my fundamental meaning, and the one that is not attached to birth and death, is all of the humans and all the rest of the things that appear to have form now in the universe. So these other views are mine as well, and this is the mind bender, right? So so this is what I'm cautioned against, is even, you know, it's like I can't set up some big contrast between these apparently very wrong ideas and then my supposedly right ones, because the truth is, I need to understand how this is all part of my actual identity of one whole thing.
It's endless.
I have a question for you. Have you read the book that I gave you, Helgoland by Carlo Rovelli, yet.
Not yet.
Well, the reason, one thing in that book that was so astonishing to me is that the relational theory of quantum mechanics is entirely what we're talking about here, that there are no separate objects, there are only interactions. And so we used to think that, oh, it's the observer who is affecting the experiment in quantum mechanics. And he goes, no, everything is affecting everything. The observer just happens to be a thing in the environment of what's going on. And of course, that's going to affect what's going on. And it's just a very profound book to me, which is why I give it to everybody. If you want a copy, I'll buy you one. but I love that we're seeing, and he does talk about Nagarjuna in this book. He's an Italian, he does quantum gravity is his field of research. And I'm not scientifically trained, but I love reading books about science. And it was just, he's very relatable, as they say. And as Buddhists, I think it's just wonderful to see this truth emerging in a scientific theory about what is. And just to me, it's just a really nice consonance of ideas from different realms. And so,
what's the book again, Jackie?
This book is called Helgoland, and Helgoland is where Heisenberg, as a 23-year-old, went to figure out something, and he came up with the fundamental ideas for quantum mechanics. And it's a really good explanation of all that, even for someone like me with no math background, but I got a lot out of it.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Carlo Rovelli, all of his books are really cool.
I read the Dancing Wooly Masters.
Oh, yeah.
And Heisenberg towards the end. So I'm kind of curious what you just said. I don't know who it was.
Yeah, I'll have to. I've forgotten.
Dancing Wooly Masters is the older book. But that's where he says that as soon as he makes the experiment, he alters what the experiment is, what the outcome is going to be. So how could you even observe in the long history of quantum physics comes to this point? But you said something beyond that.
Yeah.
And could you repeat that again?
Well, it's not that the observer affects the experiment. It's that everything is affecting the experiment. And you happen to be one of the things there. And so...
I can't quite follow that.
Right. Well, I need to bring the book in.
Multidimensionality.
Pardon?
She's talking about multidimensionality.
Oh, that's why I want to understand.
I don't know if I am. Maybe
it's cool.
Okay. Anyway, good. I guess it's a.
I think if you like that book, then you might like Carlo Rovelli. I mean, he's very science based. It's very mathematical and all that. The way it all goes, but and experimental. But yeah, I don't know.
Okay. All right. Thank you. So sure.
Oh, we have the closing, if you don't know, the closing.
Page two,
after Dharma Talk.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma Talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.